Welcome to The Telegram. I'm Tim Stanley. We have a Pope, and he is now Time magazine's Man of the Year. But is Francis really turning the church into the kind of church that Time would have it be, or is he a lot more conservative than they think? Also, everybody's going to the moon. Richard Branson tells us about his plans to build a hotel in space. I'm joined in the studio by The Telegraph's Damien Thompson, Tom Chivers, Will Heaven, and down the phone by Richard Branson. Previous Time People of the Year have included Hitler, Churchill, Nixon, Barack Obama, and you. This year, the magazine's editors have chosen Pope Francis, despite the fact that he hasn't even held his office for a year. They argue that he has begun a radical reform of the Church's image, playing down matters of the bedroom in preference for humility and a new commitment to fighting poverty. One suspects that if Pope Francis was asked who the real Man of the Year is, he'd probably answer Jesus Christ. But not everyone gets to choose their elevation to the status of celebrity, and that is what this humble, unassuming priest has become. He is, in the eyes of many journalists, the Barack Obama of the Vatican. What does this mean for ordinary Catholics, and does Time's endorsement reflect their opinion of the new Pope? Is Francis really rolling out a revolution, or, like Obama, does he offer more hope than change? I want to start by speaking to Will Heaven, who is a cradle Catholic and a young person, to ask That's what right. the Pope means to him.
Well, I think the Pope is a kind of force of energy. Pope Francis is a force of energy. You have to remember that since about 2001, we've had old and frail popes. John Paul II was diagnosed with Parkinson's disease in 2001 and was 84 when he died. Pope Benedict is 86, and it makes a huge difference that that Pope Francis, aged 76, is able to go out...
A spring chicken.
He is in Vatican terms, a spring chicken. And I think it has made the world of difference that we have someone who's able to engage and talk and walk around St. Peter's Square.
And on a personal level, has it affected your own relationship with the church? Has it made you think more deeply about it or think about it in a different way?
I'm no theologian, but I think it's certainly made it easier for me to admit publicly that I'm a Catholic.
Right.
You know, it's made being a Catholic certainly more PR friendly.
Right.
Particularly when talking to my left-wing secular friends from university.
Well, an easy solution to that would be to not talk to left-wing secular people from university. Damien, you're a slightly older Catholic. What does the Pope mean to you? You're not ashamed of letting people know you're a Catholic, of course.
Well, the Pope signals, I think, a quite remarkable change of direction in the papacy. This wasn't clear at first, but now is. He is orthodox, as traditionalists and conservatives point out. He's orthodox in the sense that he's not going to change basic teachings. He also interprets the message of Jesus in a very literal way. He tells people you've got to dirty your hands helping the poor. Selfishness is the work of the devil, which is an unfashionable subject. He interrupts his sermons sometimes to sort of blaze away about the reality of the resurrection. But he's moving the church in the direction of radical reform and also in a direction that pleases liberals, by which I mean liberals inside the church, not just the secular media.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't buy this notion, which you set out in a very well-argued blog post this morning, that there's the Pope of Time magazine, the article in Time is excellent, by the way, who's sort of seen as a wacky liberal celebrity, and there's the real Pope preaching the message of Jesus Christ. I think this Pope intends to make changes. I think he's already made changes in the way he talks about sensitive subjects. He's already said things that would have been inconceivable under previous pontificates.
Such as?
Well, for example... not long ago, Archbishop Vincent Nichols got into real trouble for saying that the church supported civil partnerships. It was gay marriage that it had a problem with. And he then denied having said it, typically for Vin. And it seems to have got him into trouble with Rome. This is under Benedict XVI. Actually, we know that Archbishop of Buenos Aires, Bergoglio, supported the state provision of civil partnerships. He was absolutely unambiguous about it. He was also unambiguous that condoms can be used to prevent the spread of AIDS, which is something that Benedict was thought to have hinted at, and then everybody said, oh, no, you misunderstand, that's not what he meant, but it's perfectly clear that Francis does think that's okay.
You're saying that as Archbishop in Argentina, he supported civil partnerships for gays and lesbians.
He did.
And he also believed that condoms should be used to prevent the spread of AIDS.
That's right.
Well, I'm sure a lot of people will be fact-checking both those quite extraordinary claims.
They're not extraordinary claims, actually, because you only have to, I mean, you know, you just have to read authoritative accounts of his time in Buenos Aires. Let me recommend Paul Valéry's book.
Okay. To go back to my personal blog post, which I'd recommend everyone listening reads for background, I'm not denying that he has a personality, and I'm not saying that he doesn't have views which may well turn out to be radical and may well end up shaping the church. What I was trying to explain to Time was that when you're dealing with a pope, you're dealing with an office. You're not dealing with a personality. What matters is the office. If the personality starts to contradict the office, that's a problem, and it undermines the office. And so what I'm saying is, so long as he is orthodox, and so long as he does what the office asks him to do, he is the Pope.
Well, all of that was really perfectly well understood by the authors of the Time article. And also, popes mould the office which they hold.
But they
like
cannot.
But they
cannot, of course, change doctrine. They cannot, of course.
Whether they can change doctrine or not is that's an interesting question, actually. There certainly are areas that they can't touch, fundamental areas of the magisterium, but they can certainly change teaching in various areas. And if this pope were to say, for example, that it's acceptable to use condoms to prevent the spread of AIDS, which Benedict seems to have hinted at, then that's a change in teaching, and it's one that has fundamental importance for the whole world, and he will have done it as pope.
Will.
I would jump in at this point and say that you're both, to me, missing the point, the thrust of his papacy so far. Peggy Noonan wrote a fantastic piece in the Wall Street Journal this week, which I've got here, where she said, I don't think the Pope is saying be a leftist. He's just saying be better, be kinder, be loving. Actually, that was symbolised in that embrace in St. Peter's Square, with a man horrendously disfigured, his face, his head, his body, his hands covered in bulbous tumours, and the Pope embraced him and kissed him. And actually, I'm sure Vatican watchers will pore over every sentence he utters in all these homilies, but actually his message is much more basic, fundamental, gospel. Kind of condensed gospel message, which is just be more like Jesus.
Yeah, I agree entirely with that. It's just that I think that the media is interpreting that message
to suit
its own agenda.
I mean, there's some truth in that. There's some truth in, but there's a lot of truth in what Will says, in that I think, as Time put it, you know, Francis' message is stop bickering and roll up your sleeves. Don't let the perfect be the enemy of the good. And yes, of course, living out the message of Jesus Christ in a particularly sort of literal and passionate way is at the centre of Francis's mission and matters to him more than anything else. And it's probably what he talks about more than anything else. Having said that, and of course, he's not saying be a leftist. On the other hand, there's quite a lot of evidence that he has moved leftwards since his days when he was a Jesuit superior, when he was implacably opposed to liberation theology. He's less opposed to liberation theology now. Even the head of the CDS has said that the war between liberation theology and the Catholic Church is over. He has, for example, contacted Leonardo Boff, who was one of the most fiery of the liberation theologians. He's now an ex-priest. He was silenced by Cardinal Ratzinger, basically on the orders of John Paul II. He's contacted Mr. Boff and asked for his writings on eco-spirituality in order that he may inform the Pope's forthcoming encyclical on the environment. Now, this is something that would, you know, infuriate traditionalists in the Church, and I think it is worth recognising, and I've noticed this happened in the last few weeks, that traditionalists and conservatives in the Church have begun to turn on Pope Francis, while recognising, of course, that he preaches the message of Jesus. They absolutely hate the people with whom he seems to be friendly.
Okay, they, Will.
Yeah. Well, I think he may well win over traditionalists in the end, just because of his immense popularity. I'm not sure the traditionalists are going to allow the left to claim him. I saw that in The Guardian he was nominated by Jonathan Friedland, it was, as Friedland's Person of the Year. This was before Time magazine.
Oh.
And Friedland is a brilliant columnist, but was clearly attempting to align himself and align the Pope with various left-wing causes.
Exactly.
On the other hand, I think Pope Francis spent, a key example, Pope Francis spent 90 minutes on a plane speaking to journalists completely off the cuff, with unscripted, about all sorts of areas of Catholic teaching. And frankly, however much people pored over it, they couldn't find anything in that 90 minutes that contradicted the Church's line on anything.
Oh, but they tried, didn't they? With the quote about not judging gay people.
They tried, but that's part of his genius, because he allowed them to try and he allowed them to read a positive message that actually, or in their eyes, a positive message that actually probably wasn't there.
Well, exactly. Actually, and he doesn't, you know, it is not his intention to contradict Church teaching. He makes it perfectly clear, I am a son of the Church, which is why, for example, there is no possibility of women priests. There's no possibility of gay marriage. There's no possibility of the Church's views on abortion changing. This is perfectly clear, and may I point out that it's also been made perfectly clear in the excellent Time magazine article. Nevertheless, there has been a softening of rhetoric in the way he talks about controversial sort of touchstone issues. And when he talks about condoms, when he talks about gay people, the language is different. And rhetoric and language do matter. They send signals throughout the Church. Another thing I think that will matter very much is that Francis seems to want to empower bishops' conferences, which is not, in my opinion, necessarily a good thing at all, particularly the feeble bishops' conference in this country.
Yeah.
That was something that was strongly opposed by Benedict. So his views on that are diametrically opposed to Benedict's, it would seem.
On this subject of the softening of the language, I mean, again, I want to make it very clear, I'm not personally attacking the Pope, and I have not done that. I have attacked the media's interpretation of what he's saying. But the softening of the language concerns some, I don't even really like the word traditionalist within the Church, but it concerns some within the Church, because the Church has to fight the culture war, because no one else will do it. If the Catholic Church, which admittedly with its many other co-religious allies, does not take a firm stand against abortion, does not talk about it, then there's a risk that it will lose the battle on it. And it is for the Church, and for those who believe that abortion is murder, it is perhaps the most significant battle going on in the world today. So I find this idea that you need to soften, you need to redirect people, I find it very troubling.
Well, put it this way. I mean, I'm glad you raised the question of the culture war, because I think Benedict was more committed to the culture war than Francis is. Francis talks with unwavering focus, really, about helping the poor.
Yes.
He doesn't think, as far as I can work out, in terms
of the culture war, which, by the way, is not the main mission of the Church.
He does also talk about salvation and the resurrection and the Virgin Mary. But he also talks about the respect he has for atheists, which is not something one can conceive by either of the two previous popes saying.
Well, it's, I presume it is respect in the sense of respecting a human being, respecting reason as a part of what one does. But of course, there has to be profound disagreement and even pity.
Oh, yes, of course. He doesn't agree with atheists. It would be a very strange sort of pope who did. My point is that the language matters. That he said such a thing, something that wouldn't have been said by his predecessors, is extremely significant.
Well,
I have a feeling that in 5-10 years' time, when, you know, whenever it happens, when this pope either dies or maybe retires, who knows how it will end, I have a feeling that at that moment, secular admirers of his will look back on his papacy with immense disappointment, because they will have read a whole load of messages in what he's been, in what he's said in his first year as Pope, and they'll feel let down because he hasn't moved towards them.
Will Heaven and Damien Thompson, thank you both very much. David Willetts, the science minister, says that in our lifetime there will be humans going to Mars, and that Britons will be among them. He wants Stevenage, a town in Hertfordshire, to become the new Cape Canaveral, and there's talk of working with the Chinese and other developing nations to put people on the moon, and, after that, to send them to Mars. It's an idea that clearly has a lot of appeal. When a Dutch company announced that it wanted to put someone on Mars, some 200,000 people came forward to volunteer, even though they knew they would never be coming back. The things people will do to escape London property prices. So how feasible is this space odyssey? What's the possible advantage of doing it? And why would anyone want to live in space anyway? If I can start by asking you, Richard Branson, do you think it is a practical proposition to go to the moon and from there to Mars?
It's certainly a practical proposition. And then a lot comes down to the cost involved in doing it. What we are doing with Virgin Galactic is something akin to what happened in early commercial aviation, and that is try to make commercial aviation in the long term affordable, and therefore try to create a big industry of people who want to go to space, and then to use the funds that we generate from sending people to space to then start developing deep space exploration, point-to-point travel at incredible speeds, satellites in space, dealing with a lot of things that they currently don't deal with, and so on. So I think if we're right in getting our first stage correct, and we start that in the next handful of months, and if we're right thinking that the demand from the public on a global basis is gigantic, and that literally millions of people would love to experience space travel, then we'll have the financial resources to do things like deep space exploration and hotels in space and ultimately trips to colonize Mars.
Okay, thank you. Tom?
Well, I was just going to ask, Richard, that you it's interesting that you think it's going to be feasible to bring costs down, as happened with commercial air flight, though, because obviously at the moment the prices are still very much on the expensive end. We're talking tens of thousands of dollars for brief flights. But you're hopeful then that in the coming decades we'll be talking about something that ordinary families might be able to do in space tourism.
Yes, I believe so. I mean, the price that we're charging at the moment for taking people into space and giving them an experience of space is about $250,000, or roughly £125,000, and that is $50 million less than it costs you to go up in a Russian spaceship today, but still not affordable for the vast majority of people. The 700 people who've signed up, and there'll be I'm sure another couple of thousand at that price, are the people that are enabling us to develop rockets which can be reusable rockets, which will dramatically bring the price down. The same happened with commercial aviation in the 1920s. The cost of flying to from New York to London was not that dissimilar to the price that we're charging to send people into space today. And over the years, the prices came down dramatically.
So in that case, how then does that feed into exploration? How do we go from obviously raising capital through space tourism to then using that money to go to the moon and then go to Mars? How does the money end up going down that route?
Simply the people who run Virgin Galactic, we're doing it because we love space exploration. We love the science of space. We want to achieve things that have never been achieved before. And And rather than, you know, sending the money back to us as shareholders, we will invest that money in, I mean, you know, the first thing we'll invest the money in is a massive array of satellites around Earth, which will be able to get telecommunications and internet access to the 3 billion people that don't currently have it. It'll bring the price of telephony and internet access and Wi-Fi access down dramatically for everybody. And that's something that only Virgin Galactic can do, because we can replenish them to our notice as they start dropping out. There'll be low Earth orbit satellites in 5 years' time.
Okay. If I can bring Tom in and ask, what are the benefits to us as ordinary members of the public? I mean, I can see for those who are excited by this, I can see for those who are going to invest in this, it's obviously very beneficial for ordinary Britons.
Well, I think Richard's touched on it a bit there. There's the obvious advantage of telecommunications. I mean, every time you use your phone, every time you use a GPS, you're dealing with the sort of low Earth orbit satellites, the sort that Richard's talking about, which has just transformed the way the world works. And it should be said as well that the way that it affects ordinary Britons is that it's a huge British industry. We've it's something like £7.5 billion a year is how much the satellite industry is worth to Britons. I'm sure Bill Richard would say, obviously Virgin's now a huge company. It's a global company, really, more than the British one. But it's a proud. We can all be proud as Britons of how much Britain is leading the world in satellite and telecommunications.
And doing so as well with developing countries, which is what surprises me. I mean, to come back to you, Richard, I always thought of space as something that governments finance. That, you know, when I think of Armstrong going to the moon, that's Cape Canaveral, that's NASA. What we're talking about here is a very different kind of model of exploration, one which is really driven by private capital.
Yes, I mean, as I say, if private capital can get a return, then everything is possible. I mean, the next exciting step, which we're already, our engineers are, you know, embarking on, is, you know, can we get somebody from London to Sydney in just over half an hour? And that is, you know, sending them into orbit at 18,000 miles an hour, and then, you know, dropping them back down, you know, in Australia. Now, the flying time will be about half an hour. The landing and the takeoff and the going through the airports will add something onto it. But it will cost us a lot of money. So we're obviously going to need to generate a lot of money in order to get our investors to believe in it. But I mean, it's something which it's so extraordinary, so exciting that, I will spend, you know, an awful lot of my waking hours trying to make it happen. And I think, you know, by dreaming big like this and getting the 300 engineers who work for Virgin Galactic and then working with David Willetts and the engineers in the UK, I think these sorts of things can become possible and can become reality. And in not so many years' time.
David Willetts has spoken about bases on the moon and eventually actually going to Mars itself. On a personal level, what's the appeal of that for you?
What Virgin are planning to do, because it's easier to do, is to put a hotel just off the moon.
Right.
And then to have a three-man spaceship, that leaves the hotel and goes around the moon, and it can be programmed to fly a few hundred feet off the moon's surface, and then comes back to the hotel at night time. Now, you know, that is a whole lot more feasible and achievable than actually setting up a base on the moon and then having to take off from there. So I think, you know, but, you know, at some stage, I mean, governments, I think, will have to put their hands in their pockets.
Right. And will there be room service? I'm only half joking. How comfortable is this going to be as an experience?
I think if you can afford the cost of getting people to the moon or to Mars, the cost of room service will be the least of your problems. I'm sure we'll get some Virgin stewardesses who'll be delighted to come and give you stewardesses or stewards give you your room service.
As a final thought, a Dutch company has said that it's willing to take people to Mars. Lots of people have signed up, some 200,000 people. Have you seen that kind of enthusiasm yourself?
Well, amusingly, about 6 years ago, Larry Page and from Google and myself were having drinks at a bar, and we came up with this idea for setting up a new company called Virgil, which would be half Virgin run and half Google run. And the idea of the company was to send people to Mars. And what we, you know, although ultimately we wanted to do that, this was very much an April Fool's joke, and we announced that that we were looking for volunteers willing to go on a one-way mission, and that they wouldn't come back to Earth. And that morning, after the announcement, there were many husbands and wives who told their respective partners and children that they were very sorry that you know, they were going to give up everything and go on this trip and volunteer. Yeah. And when at lunchtime we announced that it was an April Fool's joke, there was a lot of making up to do in these various families.
That's wonderful. Thank you so much. Richard Branson and Tom Chivers, thank you both very much.